From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin.
And I'm Dan Richards.
This Wednesday marks 1 year since the insurrection on the U.S. Capitol.
Absolutely stunning images today here at the Capitol.
Pick wisely, politicians. We are the people.
Tonight, the horror and chaos, images not seen in modern American history.
The attackers were driven by the lie that President Trump had won the election and that it had been stolen from him, a lie which was propagated by Trump himself.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing.
People are ready for fair and legal elections, or this is what you're going to get. You're going to get more of it.
The attackers, insurrectionists, whatever you want to call them, they didn't succeed in changing the election results, of course.
And the violence only lasted a few hours. But in many ways, we're still living with the damage they inflicted.
On this episode, we asked experts at Watson and Brown to help us make sense of the attack and its aftermath as we approach the one-year anniversary.
First, we asked them to reflect. What did this attack teach us about American politics?
Then we asked them to look at where we are now. Have we done anything to address what brought us to that moment of violence? Is our democracy any safer now than it was on January 6th of last year? Let's start with that first set of questions. What did the insurrection teach us about American politics? What enabled so many Americans to so quickly turn violent against their government? Dan, where should we start?
So let's start with a conversation I had with Wendy Schiller, chair of the political science department at Brown and director of the Taubman Center for American Politics and Policy. Listeners have probably heard her on the show before. And one of the most important things she thinks that we all need to understand is this.
It didn't start with Donald Trump.
There had been trends and movements growing for a long time that helped bring us to January 6th. One is the growth of something that political scientists call negative partisanship.
Okay, I know what partisanship is. Is that what she means? People being really loyal to their political parties?
Not quite.
It's one thing to be partisan and oppose the other side. It's another to make them completely illegitimate, which is what negative partisanship is all about. I hate you if you are in a different party.
It's like being more motivated by hating the opposition than by loving your own party. And President Trump certainly played into this feeling, but the precedent had really been set by Republicans in the years leading up to his presidency.
Once Barack Obama became president, when Mitch McConnell said, we will work actively to make sure that he's only a one-term president, that was something that maybe other parties had done before to opposition presidents, but never verbally stated as if it was something to be proud of.
Another underlying force has been a growing frustration in the U.S. for a long time for many people around everyday issues.
You know, people assess politics through the lens of where they are in their lives at that moment in time. And political messaging resonates with people when they are in a particular situation. So when the economy is bad, and the economy was very bad for a lot of people from 2008 all the way through 2017, then they're looking for answers and they're looking for hope. A lot of people saw that in Donald Trump, and they did not think that much about the system as is. And they thought to themselves, whatever works to make my life better, that's what I want. And so they supported Donald Trump.
And Trump maybe then could act as a sort of gateway into those feelings of negative partisanship. A third thing related to those two, the Republican Party in general and President Trump specifically became more open to letting fringe political and social groups into mainstream political life.
It used to be that this was, quote unquote, a fringe, or it was some element that sort of, you know, occupied federal land or tragically blew up a building. And you thought, OK, this isn't the dominant theme in American politics. What we've seen now, what has become uncovered, is that there are far more people who sympathize with that view than I think anybody expected.
So increasing frustration over economic and social issues over the course of years, decades. And with the help of Trump, many of those people became more partisan and started to view the other party as the, quote, enemy.
At the same time, violent fringe groups started to feel emboldened and empowered.
Yikes. That reminds me a lot of what Juliet Hooker had to say, with a few added elements. She's a professor of political science at Brown. Here's how she described the insurrection.
In a sense, it was a culmination of a long pattern, I think, of refusal to accept certain kinds of loss and then turning to subverting democracy in response.
What does she mean by loss there?
Well, she doesn't mean loss of an election per se. She thinks the insurrectionists and their supporters were maybe driven to their positions by a deeper kind of loss.
By a sense that their position at the top of the U.S. political order is being threatened.
It's a feeling that can't be understood without looking at one of the original drivers of political violence in America, race. That negative partisanship Wendy described, Juliet sees race as playing a huge role in it.
There is such sorting now in terms of race that you have one party that's seen as multiracial and another that's seen as mostly white. And what this means is that if you have people who are concerned about multiracial democracy or hostile to it, right, it's easy to convince them that these are immigrants or other undeserving racial minorities who are usurping their political standing.
But haven't the two political parties been split along pretty racialized lines for a while? Like, what got those feelings into a crisis mode?
They have, and that's a great question. Here's what Juliet would say.
I would point to two things. I think one, Trump and the sort of escalating and normalization of essentially like white nationalist rhetoric from the White House. I mean, think about all the things that were said, who his advisors were, all the things that were normalized.
So that's sort of like what Wendy was saying.
Yeah. And the second reason that Juliet gave, I was like, duh, when she said it. It's a connection that doesn't get discussed enough.
The racial justice protest in the summer. I think suddenly you had all these people out there, not just Black people. These were multiracial crowds out there asking for some sort of fundamental changes. And I think that was immensely threatening to some people.
And then there's another element. We definitely had all this dry tinder, racial resentment, economic frustration, an emboldened violent fringe. But come on, there was a big spark.
Today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved. And after this, we're going to walk down, and I'll be there with you. We're going to walk down. We're going to walk down to the Capitol.
He wanted to stay in power, and he was going to do whatever it took to stay in power, even if that meant undermining democracy as an institution.
That's Rose McDermott. She's a political scientist at Watson, and she's an expert on the psychology behind populist movements and authoritarian personalities. As she describes it, while there were lots of forces at play, as we've heard, Trump's personal role was undeniable. I asked her to be more specific.
I mean, he's such a classic narcissist. His picture should be next to the definition in the DSM. He doesn't really think about other people as subjects. They're objects, right?
Of course, Rose also sees all those other contributing forces.
Fractures along the lines of education. There are fractures along the lines of race.
Which is why she wasn't particularly surprised when she first heard there was violence at the Capitol.
I actually remember exactly where I was. I was coming out of a doctor's appointment. I got in the car and heard the report on the radio and was listening to it on the radio coming back. And I was not at all surprised because we had been hearing reports for a couple of days before that about these people who are making these plans. And actually, in a lunch group I have with some faculty at Columbia, we were quite upset the day before that the Capitol Police hadn't been given sufficient weapons and sufficient numbers. And so we were actually quite concerned. So when it happened, I wasn't surprised that it happened, but the scale of it really surprised me.
And that scale of the violence and the invasion,
how many hours it went on without anybody doing anything, you know, without the National Guard or the military or somebody being sent in. And I do think that was on Trump. I think Trump wanted this to happen. He knew that people like Mike Pence were at risk, and he just didn't care because he wanted it to be successful. He could have sent orders down hours earlier and sent in much more extensive military force in a way that would have prevented the worst aspects of the insurrection, you know, people breaching the Capitol, you know, having the Congress people have to go to their secret space, you know, so on and so forth, that kind of thing.
So that's a quick primer on what got us to January 6th. We also wanted to know, have we done anything in the past 12 months to make our democracy safer?
I talked with Stephen Kinzer about this. Stephen Kinzer, as many of our listeners may know, is a senior fellow at Watson and has reported in countries around the world that have experienced contested elections and just generally struggled with running democracies. And like Wendy, Juliet, and Rose, he wasn't terribly surprised by the attack on the Capitol, but he described the feelings through a slightly different lens.
I thought it looked pretty familiar. I've seen situations like that and processes like that in a lot of other countries. They're the countries that we look down on, the ones that we say are not stable, that don't have political processes that through which people can channel their grievances. People should not have been surprised by this. You have a very heavily armed population that's deeply divided. You have already had armed invasions of state houses, and now you have a demagogic political leader who incites those people. So we could see this all coming.
He also gave another reason for why this attack was so threatening to our country's future. It wasn't just a threat to our elections. Events like this pose a risk for our foreign policy, too.
How so?
Here's Stephen.
In the future, as America tries to stabilize its position and maintain its position in the world, people everywhere are going to be judging the big powers according to how well their political systems work at home.
He's talking here about how powerful countries compete for influence and for other countries and businesses around the world.
They are not going to gravitate automatically to the United States if they don't see that the United States has a political system that provides benefits for its people above what other kinds of political systems can produce. This is the key to our success in the 21st century. If we only rely on our military power and our coercive power, we're not going to be able to maintain our position in the world. We need to realize that building our society at home is not only something that's valuable for our own people, but in terms of foreign policy, it's going to be absolutely essential.
So anyway, back to the questions you just posed about progress we've made in the last year. I asked Stephen, does he see any reason to be optimistic about the future of our democracy?
I see something that's troubling.
Not so much at the moment. Here's what he does see.
We don't even agree on the basic facts. Two completely different narratives have developed. You have members of Congress getting up and saying, those people were just tourists.
He's referring there to people like Congressman Andrew Clyde, who months after the insurrection claimed that it was just the work of a few unorganized troublemakers, and that most people invading the Capitol that day acted in footage like regular tourists.
As long as you have that kind of magical thinking, it's hard to see how a country can come together to promote some kind of unified project.
Let's just cut to the chase. None of the experts we spoke with are feeling great about the infrastructure of our country's small-d democracy. We have a new president, but many of the underlying issues that we've been discussing remain as present as ever.
I think we're in deep trouble. I think what we are seeing is that there is now one political party that is essentially not committed to democracy.
The events of January 6th are not just about the violence and not just about the disruption of that election result, but it's the idea that the kinds of things that contained this kind of antipathy towards the government per se, these forces are unleashed, and it doesn't look like there is any single entity that can contain it. And that's frightening.
My worry there is that we're on a highway to authoritarianism.
It's not a threat from the outside. This is a threat from the inside.
And in case you didn't know this already, even professors don't have all the answers.
And I mean, I know for me, part of what's so frustrating is I feel really personally impotent. Like, what do I do? Okay, I write to my congressperson, but I live in really blue states where they're going to vote that way anyway. So, you know, I can give money to certain causes I care about, and that's valuable. But, you know, what can any one person do can be very, very frustrating.
So what then should be done in the minds of these four experts?
Let's start with Juliet. One thing she thinks is that we in the media, and all of us really, need to be more clear and direct in describing our country's politics.
So I think that one of the key things that needs to happen is that we need to be able to recognize and call out anti-democratic political activities for what they are. And I think what we take to be objectivity get in the way. And this is true not just of the media, but it's also true, for example, of political scientists, right? If you're in the classroom, you want to be quote unquote objective and you don't want to be seen to be being partisan. But if there is one party that is consistently seeming to undermine democracy, we need to be able to call that out, even if it's uncomfortable, even if it seems like we're being partisan, because there's a difference between partisan activity for political gain and activities that undermine the basic norms of democracy. And the latter we need to be able to call out as is.
Basically, if we don't identify the issue, how will we ever fix it? She also said that we need to start thinking about the next election now, like all of us.
The threat of undermining, you know, democratic results is being sown for the next set of elections at the local and state level. We all have to be doing this work of protecting equal access to citizenship and making things like voting. Voting isn't the only thing, but let's say safeguarding other kinds of democratic institutions, working against gerrymandering so that there's actual majority rule, which can be thoroughly undermined, right? That making democracy work is necessary for all of us.
That connects with something that Wendy said.
The fabric of a democracy like ours, that's built constitutionally like ours, starts at the very local level. And unless we can start to preserve it at the local level and move upwards, we're going to have cracks in our foundation.
And to fix those cracks...
Well, it's not my idea. Alexis de Tocqueville came to America in the late 1820s, 1830s, and wrote a very long book about what he saw. And what he saw was communities. Now, granted, we had the stain of slavery, we had discrimination, women couldn't vote. We certainly had the beginning of the displacement and violence towards Native Americans. It was not, you know, anything we want to brag about. But he saw that local communities were their own best arbiters and that the best reinforcement of democracy was at the local level. So if you are at a school board meeting and somebody speaks their mind, but they use false information or they use insulting or derogatory, disempowering language, the community has to say, this is not acceptable to us. If you want to participate in this community meeting, these are the rules.
But if government is perceived by lots of people as ineffective or worse, illegitimate, how do we convince them to participate at all?
Right. Well, Stephen had a few ideas on that front, based on his experience in other countries that have struggled with legitimacy issues.
First thing I think is that basic rules of democracy have to be guaranteed.
Similar to Juliet and Wendy.
Definitely. Uniform agreement there.
You need to have an openness to accepting the will of the majority. And when you have these great efforts to reduce voting rights and to gerrymander districts, to produce skewed political outcomes, you're denying citizens the normal courses of action that they can take to make political change. This is the key to preventing instability in countries. You have to make change possible through legal channels.
But again, though, you get into that problem you just mentioned. How do you get people to trust that a government has fixed itself when they don't trust the government to do things? And this gets to Stephen's next recommendation, which is based a little bit more in the material world.
And the next thing is to provide credibility to government so that government projects are actually working for the benefit of people. I think so much of what we're seeing in the protest movements that are tearing America apart today is a reaction to the fact that after decades of budget cutting, our government really doesn't meet the needs of many of its people. And therefore, people don't feel that they have a stake in maintaining the governing system. So I think to me, that is a deep root of our problems. And as long as we are dismantling the state and not providing services that people expect from government, we can't be surprised when people have contempt for government and feel like if they destroy it, they're not losing much.
And he actually sees a little reason for hope around this second point.
I think the possibility that the infrastructure bill will provide some positive benefits out there is a beginning. I think it's very important that the state reassert itself as a positive force in society. Otherwise, people don't feel it's necessary.
Okay, and keeping with the happy thoughts, something has happened that Wendy pointed out is progress and shouldn't be taken for granted.
I think for listeners who really want to believe in the rule of law, that it's still intact, the good news is that there have been hundreds of arrests and prosecutions of the people who directly participated in the violence of January 6th, and a lot of convictions and prison time and penalties and punishments. And that's what you want to see. Now, they're not easy to find all the time. You have to pay attention and look for them. But it's almost, you know, it's a year later, and we are seeing individuals paying consequences for breaking the law and trying to violently overthrow a peaceful election. And that will continue until they get every single person they think should be prosecuted. And that is sort of the slow engine of the American legal system. But it's very important that it keep chugging along, because it restores our faith in the fact that if you break the law and you get violent over an election, you are going to be found, you are going to be charged, you are going to be convicted, and you will have to serve some sort of sentence.
Well, that is nice to hear.
And you know, I think there's another piece of progress that we've made as a country after talking with all these experts.
Go on.
So our country's democratic institutions are under threat.
Yeah, I thought you said this was progress.
No, no, hear me out. A lot of the underlying trends and forces we've heard about on this episode, they've been with us for a while, slowly eating away at the foundations of our democracy. But prior to January 6th of last year, lots of us maybe didn't take these threats as seriously as we should have. As Stephen said,
I think there's been an assumption in the United States that we established our democracy. It's fixed, it's in concrete, it's always going to be like this. The Constitution will always be respected, and it's a permanent institution. History tells you that that's a very dangerous thing to believe.
Yeah, Juliet had a similar insight.
What's been revealed is the fragility of the institutions, the way that they're working often in undemocratic ways, but also the inability or unwillingness of our elected officials to sort of rise to the moment and grapple with, or many of them, to grapple with the current crisis. And so I think that part of the lesson, if you will, of January 6th is that working for democracy is something that we all have to do. And so I think for us as citizens, as part of the general public, we need to not be complacent and think that the danger has passed. It hasn't passed.
And maybe more of us recognize the reality of this threat now than we did 12 months ago. And we're learning that we're all going to have to work to keep this democracy going. Maybe that's at least something that's changed in this country. As Rose put it,
people can't pretend that the underlying polarization and conflict isn't real and isn't consequential. And, you know, like being an alcoholic, sometimes the first thing is you have to admit it.
At least it's a start. This episode was produced by Dan Richards and Kate Dario. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. Additional music by the Blue Dot Sessions. You can read more expert analysis of the insurrection and its aftermath on the Watson Institute's website. We'll put a link in the show notes. And if you haven't already, you can subscribe to Trending Globally wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.